the wrong football team, but he is a fellow at the Wright College. Will you please give a Swindon Professor of Literature welcome to Danny Dawley?
Thank you ever so much. It's slightly bright and I need to be able to see it, so I'm going to move out. Right, I thought, because of what's just happened, we'll start off with a poll. Because we know that these things are very, very reliable. So this has to help me, and I need to find out about Swindon. So, can you put your hand up if you were born in Swindon for me? Oh yeah, we've got quite a few. Put your hand up if you weren't born in Swindon. Oh, okay, let you off. Can you put your hand up if you're born in Wiltshire? It's got smaller. It can't get smaller. Okay, your hand up if you were not born in, even in this county, not born in Wiltshire. Vast majority of you. Welcome migrants.
Always like migrants.
There'll be some relevance of this in a bit. Actually, you have... When I do this in Oxford, I get hardly anybody born in Oxford and hardly anybody born in Oxfordshire. So you're doing slightly better. One last one. Can you put your hand up if you voted Conservative but you were too shy to tell a pollster? No? No. See, we're going to have our work... we're going to have our work cut out trying to understand this. It's really, really tricky trying to get people to tell you about things they're a little bit embarrassed about. The reason for asking you about Swindon is... I've known Swindon for a very long time because I grew up in Oxford. The real opposition to Oxford is not Cambridge, of course, it is Swindon. The football's a bit upsetting at the moment, but it won't take long. Sorry. But this town was different. This town was different in the past. What's happened? I'm actually saying this map is no good for this. You need a proper kind of cartoon. I like the cartoon so much, I have to put that up. If you saw the election result on a cartogram, which is a map that stretches, you know the hexagons outside New Broadcasting House on election night that they kind of did? If you looked at that, then the centre of the biggest sea of blue in the country is now here. This is the very heart of it. You're in the heart of it. And I was driving around the station earlier trying to work out, what? What on earth? What on earth? You have to go all the way to Oxford, not just to Oxford, but Oxford East, to find a speck that isn't blue anymore. Or all the way to Bristol, Bristol West. This is an incredible change. And I think part of it
has to do with people moving around the country and who's here. And a lot of it has to do with housing. It's all geographical. The map is very geographical. Our society is incredibly polarised between spaces, and that polarisation is increasing. So if you look at those seats which went. Essentially, forget Scotland. Scotland's gone and done something different. Something remarkably interesting that we are not paying enough attention to because it's Scotland. But this is the first time, I think, since 1918 that the Third Party has polled this many seats. And in 1918, the Third Party was Sinn Féin. It got 73 seats in what is now the Republic. So the most interesting, the most dramatic thing that's happened in the election is Scotland. It is stunning. And 50-odd people who've never been members of Parliament before are about to arrive in London. And they're everyday people. It's really interesting to look at the pictures of them. Either London media is going to ignore them or they're going to start saying things about society that are going to be very interesting. But if we forget about Scotland for the rest of the talk... down here, if you look at which of those Liberal seats went which way, and essentially that's all that happened, the Liberals just lost a load of seats to the Tories and slightly fewer seats to Labour, it was the ones in which people were renting houses that went Labour. It's the ones in London, it's Cambridge. Those are the ones that went Labour. It's the ones where people, round here, the ones where people owned their house or had a mortgage but weren't largely renting, down in the southwest in particular, they all went Tory. And the country is dividing sharper and sharper along lines of wealth and polarisation.
In Oxford East, we've now got up for the first time for decades to a 50% Labour vote. It went up at the last election, it's gone up again now. And what's changed in Oxford East? We haven't got poorer. There's almost no unemployment. The wages have gone up. There are more jobs than you can possibly fill, which is why our schools can't actually get teachers. The only thing that's changed in Oxford East to make the Labour Party more and more popular is that increasing numbers of people are losing almost all their income in rent. And it doesn't make them very happy when that happens, and they leave. They go. So we have this constant churn. People come, they stay, they work in a school for a short amount of time, and then they're off because they have to have a life. They might want to have a family, they might want to do all those things, and they cannot do those things in that part of the country. And soon they may not be able to do those things in this part of the country. I was doing a talk in Whitney a few months ago, and I checked the house price rise in Whitney, and it had gone up £70,000 in the last year. There's a wave coming out of London. When London blew up, when London house prices went to an average of £500,000 for a three-bed semi in an average part of London, £500,000, that hasn't just affected London. So there's a much damper wave. As it comes out, it falls down, so 70,000 in a year is actually low compared to what happened in London. But when it comes through here, and it may, well, it's probably going to come through here next week, to be honest, given the election result. You know, you can all sit there. Oh, well, not all of you, I'm being unfair. I won't ask you to put up your hands about your 10-year ownership. We won't get really embarrassing because we're in England and we don't do these things. But a large number of you, given your age and my guesses, may sit there thinking, oh, I'm £30,000 richer. You know, isn't this great? And then you'll wonder why the area is getting older and older and older, and why primary schools are having trouble keeping going in some of the villages around the place. Because as the wave moves through, unaffordability rises. Somebody has to be buying for the wave to move through. You can't have house prices rising without somebody buying. And the people who are buying are landlords. It's increasingly landlords who are buying. The research on this is done by Savills. Savills, the estate agent, are worried about what's happening to the housing market. It's published by the Financial Times, which is worried about what's happening, about the unaffordability of our housing, and about a shift back towards a time when the majority of people will rent again, and rent again from private landlords. Now, that isn't necessarily problematic. Most European countries have far more people renting from private landlords. It gives you some flexibility. It is problematic if the rents are so incredibly high that you're not left with anything at the end of the day to do much else with. And it is problematic if you can be chucked out with 2 months' notice, unlike in most of the rest of Europe. Particularly if you've got kids. 2 years ago, well, so 10 years ago, less than 10% of families with kids were renting privately. And most of those who were renting privately were doing it for a short amount of time between moving between more stable tenure. 2 years ago, that proportion had gone up to a quarter. Absolutely shot up after the financial crisis. One in four of all families who have children are renting in the private sector. This has a terrible effect on almost certainly the majority of those children. You can get stable private renting. It is rare, and it's particularly rare in the growth sector. So what happens to those families with children is that after 9 months, or if you're lucky, 18 months, the landlord wants to put the rent up, or something else goes wrong, and they can't afford to stay there, and they have to move. And somebody else comes in, often a couple without children, because they can pay higher rent than somebody with children. The family with children might have noticed that their income has been dropping. They won't quite know why, because hardly anybody can understand tax credits. So you could cut tax credits again and again and again. But they can't afford to stay in that property. So they have to move. They might move fairly nearby, but not quite nearby enough for the kids to go to the same school anymore. So you lose all your friends. And then you've got to do it again, 18 months later, and again. And this was never the plan. Nobody sat on a yacht with a couple of Russians and Peter Mandelson and some friends that they'd had in a photograph for their little club in Oxford many years ago and met and said, let's do this. It isn't the way you would engineer a new kind of neoliberal society. You wouldn't do it this fast and you wouldn't do it this painfully. We have a disaster in housing, which affects a very large number of people, from the homeless on the streets, which are rising, to people who are insecurely housed, to all these children in these situations, right up to the most successful young professionals, not even young, I call everybody young nowadays, as I'm getting older, professionals in their late 30s in London, the ones who've done everything right, have managed to hang on in there, have got the jobs, have moved around, have got their salary way up, I don't know, £90,000 or something. Right, but remember, that three-bed semi, £500,000. Think what kind of mortgage you're going to get with £90,000. Maybe you can find somebody who's got a salary of £40,000. You can get together and you can go and beg a bank for that enormous mortgage. This is a mortgage bigger than all your siblings, all your parents, all your grandparents ever had put together. But don't worry, interest rates are low, so it's fine. You can go and beg for this enormous mortgage and you can have that three-bed semi, as long as you pay the repayments back for 25 years on it. And the fear, the worry, is that you're the sucker who buys the three-bed semi for £500,000 the month before it drops down to 400,000, because that's your debt. I'm going to talk about the 1% a bit more later, but housing is big, and I've written about housing issues. It's frightening for a huge number of people, and it's becoming more frightening and more scary, and it's not working. And a large part of the reason that we're in this situation, that our housing market has gone up so very, very high, is that the main objective of the Chancellor of the Exchequer at every budget since 2010, the thing he has spent more money on than anything else, is to hold house prices up and increase them. So the reason we got a Help to Buy scheme, which is the underwriting now of up to 130 billion of mortgages, was to get banks and perhaps our one remaining large building society, but it doesn't like it, so largely banks, to lend to people who they would otherwise not risk lending on because the risk is too much. And the banks will lend to people with a Help to Buy mortgage because if and when prices do at some point fall, if and when prices fall, you're liable for the first 5%, and then we collectively are liable for the next 20% of the fall. So as long as the prices don't fall by more than 25% at some point in the future, the bank doesn't lose out, so it lends. So why would a government do this? We now have the most expensive house prices in the world in London. Why would a government try to raise prices? Part of the reason is rational. If you go right back to 2008, 2009, you had house price crashes across the whole of Europe. You had house prices halving in value in Madrid and in Dublin, in fact in a band all the way from Cyprus right up to Iceland, just excluding the southeast of England. The Labour government, if you remember back that far, in their last year the Labour government took half of the budget for regional aid and put it into a mortgage rescue scheme for the southeast of England, because they were worried about a crash in the south of England. But the coalition government that took over just did more and more and more. And I think they did it really for them, or at least for one part, as it turned out, of the coalition, eminently sensible reason. The man who did it, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, was also in charge of the election campaign for the Conservatives. The one thing which stops people voting Conservative, which we've seen again and again, is when their houses fall in value. Conservative voters, a large portion of them, simply stay at home when the house falls in value. Because what are they voting for? We saw it most obviously in London in the early 1990s. After the mini house price crash in 1989, the Conservatives lost a whole ring of boroughs. People didn't go out to vote for them. It wasn't that the Labour vote surged, it was that people who saw their property fall in value didn't vote for the party that was telling them, if you work hard and look after yourself, you'll do okay. So if house prices had been allowed to steady or to fall, I don't think you would have seen this election result. And when people begin to study the British election study and many of the other pieces of work that have been done and work out a way to determine how people actually voted, because the problem with all these election studies is they ask the same kind of questions that the pollsters ask. But when they look into this in detail, and you begin to get the results out about September, October, November, I think you'll see self-interest there. Or what looks like self-interest. I'm a geographer, so you might be wondering, what on earth am I doing talking about this? Housing is incredibly geographical. Voting, of course, is incredibly geographical. Housing is geographical because a house is not just a good that you can buy. It's not like buying fine wine. I don't care about the fine wine market. I don't care if you lot over there want to buy loads of fine wine, the price of fine wine goes up, and you lot here who've got slightly less income say you can't afford to buy fine wine anymore. It's a bit sad for you, but it really isn't the end of the earth. But housing uses up space that other people could be using. If you get increased selfishness in housing, if you get people in the middle of London buying flats to leave empty simply as an investment, that increases misery for the rest of the population. There was a point a couple of years ago when Norman Tebbit was being driven home by his chauffeur from the Lords, a long way home by his chauffeur from the Lords, and he lamented that he didn't really mind having to live so far away from where he worked. It was having to be driven past so many houses with no lights on, where clearly nobody was sleeping in Kensington, where he could have actually just slept for the night. It's that inefficiency which affects people right at the top and right at the bottom. We've measured the number of rooms in homes and the number of people since 1911. In each census, we've measured the number. In 1911, we were very unequally housed. We had the Downton Abbeys and we had the Rookeries and we had slums. And we had, I think, the worse off tenth of the population were living in about 3.5 fewer rooms per person than the best off tenth. The worst off tenth then was a family of four living in one room. And for the best off tenth, you'd have the kids would have their own room and a mum and dad would be sharing a room. And that, you get that kind of ratio. It got better from 1911 to 19... So it got worse from 1911 to 1921. Inequalities increased. But then they got better to 31, through to 51. The war meant we couldn't count it in 41. Through to 61, through to 71, through to 81... The ways in which we housed ourselves improved. It wasn't just that the quality and the amount of housing went up and we built council housing of a high quality that private builders also built, but at the same time, each successive decade, we fitted into this stock slightly better than we had before, which meant that the worst off 10 were better and better and better housed. So that you reached the heady days of 1981, when the worst off 10 had three times less rooms per person than the best off 10th. We still have massive inequality, but we'd never been as equal as in 1981. And then the graph begins to zoom up to 2001, 2011. 2011, the best off 10th of the population have five times more rooms per person than the worst off 10th. We have absolute overcrowding rising again in the southeast. At the extremes, we have families sharing properties, and we know we have families living in single rooms again, at the very extremes. It's not as bad, of course, as 1911, but it's going in the wrong direction. We're having teenage siblings of the opposite sex having to share bedrooms, or having to share a room with their uncle of the opposite sex, the kind of things you really thought we'd got rid of by the 80s and by the 90s. We've got people sleeping on sofas, we've got rooms, we've got buildings being let out with no living room, and sometimes with the fridge and a cooker on the stairs, because you can let out the kitchen at this point. And the main reason that this is happening is that there's another set of housing which has got more and more and more empty rooms, including in London. In London, there are more bedrooms, forgetting the hotels, just in the flats and houses, there are more bedrooms than there are people. So if nobody in London wanted to sleep in the same bed as anybody else any night, if you all just wanted to sleep in your own bed, there are enough rooms to do it. But But the housing stock is being used less and less efficiently because it's gone straight through to the private market. Private landlords have bought the right to buy property and they're letting it out. And they'd let it out to whoever can pay the most. So if one single professional can pay more than a family, that single professional gets the maisonette, which used to be allocated to the council. But you can just tell I can go on and on and on about this. Far too much. But it's a mess. You could build 200,000 houses a year and it wouldn't help improve the mess at all. Because until you address the increased inefficiency of housing, you don't address it. We saw it in the election campaign. The Milibands had two kitchens. There are increasing numbers of families in London who have two kitchens and other spare rooms. Cameron had three kitchens, right? And this idea of multiple rooms. You know, they're digging down in Kensington and Chelsea and putting, basements and so on. And the most stupid thing, a few months ago, I was standing in a three-bed semi in Mayfair, down two levels, subterranean swimming pool. The most stupid thing to put in a house. I mean, it's lethal. Really is. Anyway, it's going for 25 million. The house is going for 25 million with a death trap in the basement. And the population of Kensington and Chelsea has been falling in the last 10 years. There are fewer and fewer people living there while people dig out more and more rooms for those fewer and fewer people to enjoy. It's a mess. It's a geographical mess. Another part of the mess is a fortunate mess, but it is difficult, which is ageing. So because we're living older, our housing stock was very efficient when we tended to die in our 70s in the family home. But now many of us make it through to our 80s and 90s. We don't have a stock locally near our big family home to move to, which is on the flat for when our hips go and is near our friends. So if you are arguing for building, the building we most need is building near where we live, not up in Newcastle, near where we live for us as we get older so we can get out when we choose to at the family home. But what we also need is a reason to get out. And at the moment we don't have a reason to get out of housing that we're overoccupying, even if we can't afford to heat it. Because the housing is going up in value. And even if you don't care, and you don't because you're not going to see the value because you're living in it, your grandchildren's only chance of housing themselves is if you hang on in that house long enough so that they can inherit enough money so they can get a deposit and join in on this. So you're getting individual little welfare states of families incredibly inefficiently using housing. And it makes no collective sense. And it's going to get worse, I'm afraid, for the next few years. However, this doesn't really cheer you up very much, and predictions are very bad. Our housing prices in London are now the highest in the world of any large city. Until recently, the most expensive city in the world was Tokyo. Tokyo is the most expensive city in the world, despite having had the biggest house price fall around about 1990, when prices halved. If you carry on having house prices rise, eventually you get a fall, because there eventually ends up being nobody to buy the houses. There are a lot of potential landlords, not amateur landlords, but there are a lot of landlords, but they can't buy everything. The bulk market to buy are middle class people in their 30s. And we've managed to scupper that market in the future. So if you were sitting here thinking, my house is worth 30,000 more now, half of our young women in Britain now go to university. All three university years, the first, second and third year at university, all have the £9,000 fees. If you do well in the labour market, if you get a good job, then you have the privilege of paying back more. So you have to pay back about £56,000. If you do really well, you have to pay back even more. So the people who do well in the next 10 years will have a debt of £56,000 at the point that they enter the market to try to buy your house or a flat. So you can tell when the fall has to happen. You just don't know when, in between then and now, what's going to occur. And the other thing you don't know about is what does the Chancellor of the Exchequer do now? His main reason for holding the housing prices up was to do what he's just achieved. And didn't he do well? But he doesn't need to do that now. And maybe he can't afford to do it anymore. Because the amount of effort it takes, every budget coming up with a new wheeze. The latest one was letting you take out your pension annuity and bung it into a property. Right? Every budget's a new wheeze. You can't carry on coming up with these wheezes. And they don't always work. They can't always work. Pensioners might say, actually, this isn't a very safe thing to put my money in. On top of that, people from China might decide they don't want to invest here. It might not be hot property anymore for them. Or all those people who had their money in the Swiss bank accounts who took it out quickly because the Americans were allowed to look at it last year. That's not going to happen again. So we haven't voted for stability. That isn't what people have got. What they voted for is a kind of con trick of you'll be okay, trust us, use the evidence of what's happened to your home and you can see that we can do it again. Now maybe they were right to be scared of what a Labour and SNP government would have done with a mansion tax and the rest of it. But if you stoke it up even higher, if you don't begin to address these things earlier, you get more precarity and more fear in the future and more uncertainty. It doesn't solve the problem. Coming back right at the end, I'll just 2 more minutes and then I'll open up for questions because I'm sure there's lots of other things you'd like me to talk about, in particular the party of the 1%, which I'm happy to do. But right at the end, building houses. One of the reasons, not the biggest one, the biggest reason is growing inequality, and the second one is ageing, but the third reason why our house prices have gone up so much is immigration. We're very lucky. It's much worse. When people don't come, things are bad. But immigration means we have more people to house. No politician in the election campaign was willing to explain that you can't have this many people arriving every year and not build more housing. The great news is that we don't need to knock any housing down. Population's going up everywhere, we're stable everywhere. There's no need to knock half of Sunderland down anymore. It's doing fine. It's doing fine because of polls. Not any old polls. I heard this from a German. And apologies to anybody who's Polish. Well, you might like this if you're here in Polish. Apologies, you've got a friend in Germany. A friend from Germany, of course, they let the polls in later, said, you got all the good ones. You got the ones with the most get up and go, the most university certificates, the ones who really thought what they were doing. We've gone and got the ones who thought about it a bit later and they're not quite as good. We have had an enormous amount of immigration. It's mainly to London and the South East. We do need to build for that immigration. You can build up in London. You cannot build up in Oxford. They really won't let you. I won't say where I've been found. I'm not even going to try and do that. So somewhere like Oxford, you need to build around the edge of the city, just on the hills, preferably retirement flats is what I like. see, because what's the point of having all these views if you've got nobody... Do you know Oxford's, I'm in Swindon, but Oxford's got these 6 protected views and there is no requirement for anybody to be able to see the views, and one of them, the trees have actually grown up so high you can't see the view. Anyway, the reason why we do need some building down here, and it'll probably be around Swindon too, is we've got to stop having so many people driving over to Greenbelt every day. In Oxford we have 40,000 people drive over to Greenbelt. It's not good for them. Carbon is not a particularly good thing to put in the atmosphere. That's geographical as well. And we're going to have this kind of argument and it's going to heat up. My worry is that what we're going to start getting in the Greenbelt in the South East will be Barratt homes. I say Barratt because Barratt sponsored the Centre for Cities report on the Greenbelt. Barratt homes, detached, with 2 spaces for 2 cars at low density, sprawling out. What we need is homes near in, tight, where the main mode of moving is cycling. In the Netherlands, 1/4 of pensioners cycle. Here it's only 1% of pensioners cycle. But you're going to watch the land being opened up to developers now, and I would go in for quite a lot of NIMBYism if they're going to build to maximise profit and building large houses with car spaces rather than building housing that's closer, nearer in for the kind of people who are currently living in Birmingham and coming here, or the people who are living here and going on that road of death to Oxford every day. You do not want people having to commute where they don't need to commute. We are going to have to build some more housing for them. Very happy to try and answer any of your questions. Thank you for listening to my rant.